Welcome to the Global Gaming Business Podcast, the industry's first and longest-running podcast, now in our 16th year. I'm Roger Gross, the publisher of GGB, and this week we sit down with Jonadeb Chowdhury, the founder of Chowdhury Law, about how he's been keeping busy following his departure as chairman of the National Indian Gaming Commission. This week's program is brought to you by Konami Gaming. Later in the show, we'll talk about two Konami slot series ranked top-grossing premium lease games by Eilers and Krycek.
It keeps me searching for a heart of gold, and I'm getting old.
In nearly 6 years as chairman of the National Indian Gaming Commission, Jonadeb Chowdhury is credited with bringing some stability to the federal regulatory process overseeing tribal gaming. His emphasis on education and training brought a new level of professionalism to the tribal regulatory boards. Following his resignation, he became an ambassador for his tribe, the Muskogee Creek Nation of Oklahoma, where he represents the tribes in ceremonies and negotiations. He recently founded Chowdhury Law, which gives him the freedom to pick and choose his clients and dedicate his time to causes and issues that are close to his heart. He spoke with me from his home office in Washington, D.C. in November.
I've been in my mind. It's such a fun.
Welcome to the Global Gaming Business Podcast. Our guest today is Jonadeb Chowdhury, the former chairman of the National Indian Gaming Commission and now an Indian gaming lawyer, you know, involved in all kinds of tribal issues. And Jonadeb, thanks for joining us. It's really good to see you. You know, we haven't gotten together for a while, but, you know, we caught up, you know, frequently when you were chairman. So it's really good to see you again.
Yeah, and thanks for having me, Roger. It's great to see you virtually. Hopefully, we're getting very close to the point where we'll see each other in person on a regular basis.
For
together.
Sure.
But thanks so much for having me.
Right. So, you know, you did such a great job at the NIGC, but I guess you were fortunate to leave right before the pandemic hit, you know. It seems that the agency navigated the pandemic as well as they could, and according to your successor, Sequoia Simmermeyer, in your view, how did tribal gaming in general respond to that, to the pandemic? Do you think they came out of it, you know, in a healthy way?
Well, as is often the case, I think Indian gaming provided a roadmap for not just the gaming industry as a whole, but for the entertainment industry as a whole. So, you know, hats off to the NIGC in terms of issuing the guidance that issued regarding best practices. There was also similar guidance issued by NTGCR and some guidance that was very helpful from very specific tribes that other tribal nations look to use as models for the immediate, aftermath of the initial closures. So we had an industry that overnight shuttered all of its facilities, even before any state requests in many cases, and certainly before many commercial operations shuttered their facilities, and was willing to do so as a joint effort to protect patron safety, but also the safety of tribal members and citizens. And so it was a huge, huge blow to the bottom line for the Indian gaming community and tribal nations across the board. However, I was proud of the leadership that Indian country provided in making those tough calls. And over time, there was a methodical reopening to the point that, with a few exceptions, Indian gaming operations are open and running in accordance with best practices that have evolved over the last year and a half as more scientific information has come about. So you saw the industry take a real hit, but come through it, and come through it in a way that I think everybody can be proud of in terms of the closures, but methodical reopenings. And NIGC played a part in that. And, I miss being part of the whole team. I typically don't comment on my my successor, as I never really commented or too strongly one way or the other in my predecessors. But certainly the team there knows what it's doing, and I look forward to hopefully them playing a leadership role in some of these other national policy issues that are coming around the pike.
Sure, no question. And I think tribal casinos are also taking the leadership in an important role when it comes to the non-smoking initiative. You know, we've seen, you know, five or six tribal casinos reopen and not reinstitute the smoking policy they had. And we just saw last week the Navajo Nation banned smoking in all of its public buildings, including its casinos. And I think that's really a healthy thing, not only for the customers, but also for the employees.
You know, that's a point that I've always tried to make. There's a significant difference in philosophy between tribal gaming operations and other commercial activities. And, you know, I'm not even drawing this distinction between Indian gaming and commercial gaming. I'm just talking about commercial activities as a whole, because these are governance activities, you know, emanating from tribal governing authority. There's a driving interest among tribal nations to protect their communities first and foremost. So what that means is, yes, revenue is important. Revenue provides needed operations, needed services, but the bottom line is the health of the community. And because the profits, they're not profit-based operations, they're right. government revenue-based operations. Mm-hmm. And the whole point of that is strengthening your community. So you see case-by-case decisions, tough decisions that don't always necessarily serve the bottom line right. financially, but over the long term may improve the overall health and welfare of the local community.
So yeah, no question.
In Indian gaming, you're really talking about local decision making, mm-hmm. which I think tribal citizens and non-citizens alike benefit from.
Yeah, no question about that. So there's been a lot of issues lately in the recognition and land into trust decisions. Just last week, a bill passed in Congress that recognized the Lumbee tribe and affirmed that the Catawba tribe could operate in North Carolina. And this is opposed, of course, by the Eastern Band of Cherokees, who really run the only casinos right now in North Carolina, and some other tribes have joined with them. Are you concerned that there's a fracture in Indian country over these issues, that, you know, tribes, you know, aren't really supporting each other, or, you know, and maybe some commercial reasons also come into that?
Well, there's certainly commercial interests at stake, and I can't speak to those specific, you know, examples that you mentioned, but here's the underlying problem. The nature of U.S. Indian policy is a dark and disappointing one, and we're at a point where tribal nations are not uniformly situated throughout the country as a result of that policy. And I often think about the late Colin Powell's comment about the pottery barn concept.
If right.
you break it, you buy it. And the result of U.S. policy has left some tribes, you know, hundreds, in our case, thousand miles away from our homelands. You have tribes, in some cases, near huge metropolitan areas, some very, very rural. And you're in a situation where the federal government, through the trust responsibilities that it has to Indian country that flow from treaties that provided the federal government in the United States with significant lands to help build this country, is in a position where, in order to do what's right, the federal government has to support economic development in Indian country. But in upholding its responsibilities, it can't do so on the backs of other tribal nations. And that's the situation we're in. When you talk about the pottery barn, you break it, you buy it situation, federal government has created these disparities and it has a responsibility to address them. The trick and the challenge is, how does the federal government do it without further trepidations on other tribal nations? And it really is case by case. I mean, we often equate it to a merry-go-round. You know, we all grew up with those playgrounds that, you know, broke many collarbones of kids growing up, because you'd spin on,
right.
on them, and depending on how fast it was going, you'd fly off. That's kind of where Indian policy has left tribal nations. Some tribes are, you know, fell off and broke collarbones. Some tribes went in this direction, mm-hmm. that direction. And so as you try to figure out a policy that fits everyone, you just can't do it with a one-size-fits-all approach.
Sure.
And so with those situations, I think the federal government has to take special steps to ensure that no additional malfeasance occurs to existing tribal nations to ensure that things such as sacred sites protections mm-hmm. are maintained as other tribes, pursue economic opportunities, and that tribal nations that are impacted are actively consulted with. I think that's important regardless of where tribes ended up after getting flung off the merry-go-round.
Sure. Okay. Let's talk about online gaming and sports betting on tribal lands. You know, we saw a coalition of tribes and casinos work together in Michigan for the benefit of both sides and the state as well. In other states, though, there's a question of tribal sovereignty being violated if any other entity is given the right to offer gambling online or sports betting. You know, Connecticut seemed to have worked out a pretty good deal between the two tribes there and the race and sports book side of it. Is there room for compromise in any of these remaining states now?
There absolutely is, but we have to keep a couple things in mind. As you talk about online gaming is a delivery mechanism for certain types of gaming products.
Right.
And so there's nothing necessarily that ties online gaming to sports betting or any other specific types of products. As a result, you have to think about how IGRA regulates gaming activities on tribal lands, and to the extent that it has any role whatsoever off of eligible tribal lands. That's an important question as we try to come up with these compromises. So you mentioned Michigan, and some states, tribes and states have pursued IGRA-based solutions, mm-hmm. namely through some sort of agreement, agreeing that maybe the location of the servers allows for gaming to take place off of eligible Indian lands. And as a result, you can kind of shoehorn these activities into a legal package that allows for gaming to occur off the reservation lands. So tribes and states in some situations have developed IGRA solutions or IGRA-based solutions.
Sure.
Tribes in other states have developed non-IGRA solutions. They've gone the commercial licensing route, which through compacting processes allow tribes to compete for specific licenses for gaming off of reservations mm-hmm. that aren't rooted in IGRA itself. Those are two separate different types of philosophical approaches to online gaming that we're talking about.
Okay.
So Michigan's solution was very interesting. It involved an agreement among the significant tribes involved in the state so that they could come up with these IGRA types of solutions. But it was very different than the compacts, say, in Arizona,
sure, right.
where the tribes that are allowed to pursue gaming sports betting off of tribal lands have to go through the commercial licensing route, the mm-hmm. non-IGRA route.
Right.
So where there's a will, there's a way with these things. But, I always try to point out that whenever you're talking about large scale solutions, the role of Indian gaming flows from a longstanding treaty relationship that the tribes have with the United States that's different than commercial gaming. And that needs to be kept in mind in any national approaches to regulation of these activities.
Sure. And, the fact Michigan, the tribes of Michigan didn't have a monopoly on casinos up there. They had some commercial casinos as well. So, for them to get involved in this, I think that made sense. And in a state like California, however, the tribes do have a monopoly on casino gaming. So, if they give up an inch there, does that threaten their tribal sovereignty in your understanding?
Well, California is very, very complicated because of the role of the state legislature there
right.
and the constitutional rules that apply. But I think what is clear in California is what should be clear in other states. California has recognized the benefit of Indian gaming to non-tribal citizens mm-hmm. that goes beyond specific revenue sharing. I mean, because of this longstanding relationship of the tribes to the state in California, where tribes have effectively been the sole operators of gaming in that area. I know there are card rooms that have kind of their own unique claims, but because of this longstanding relationship. You have decades of data to show the benefits on non-tribal citizens that go beyond, that involve jobs, sure. that involve infrastructure, that, right. you know, that all needs to be taken into account when a state is negotiating with a tribe. Mm-hmm. You contrast that with a state like Oklahoma, which the governor is convinced that there should be no additional sports betting unless there's an increase in revenue share. Right. Or, and in order to support this argument, the governor will compare the revenue sharing that goes on in Oklahoma to tax rates of commercial gaming in various states. It truly is comparing apples to oranges, and it doesn't recognize those benefits that go beyond revenue sharing or even taxation. You know, the tax rates of that apply to commercial gaming lead to very different benefits to a state than Indian gaming does for sure. all the reasons I mentioned before.
Right.
When you're supporting commercial gaming, where profits often go to shareholders, often in other countries, you don't have that local decision-making benefit that Indian gaming has. So sure. as states negotiate these compacts with tribes, they need to see the full picture of the bottom line benefit to the states in supporting Indian gaming. And you're seeing that those discussions play out differently, you know, in Oklahoma sure. versus California,
right.
As they played out differently in Arizona and Michigan.
Sure, yeah. Since September, two high-performing Konami slot series have ranked in Iroh's and Krychek's list of top-performing parent games / premium leased. Both All Aboard and Ocean Spin have demonstrated consistently strong results, and both are available now on Dimension 49J, awarded first place for best slot product in this year's GGB Gaming and Technology Awards. Learn more by visiting konamigaming.com/premiums. So you mentioned online gaming, and I think you know, the tribes have always opposed online gaming because they, you know, the locations of most tribal casinos are pretty remote, so people have to travel to get there, and the tribes were always afraid that, you know, if they allowed online gaming, people wouldn't come as frequently as they did in the past. But at the same time, during the pandemic, you know, New Jersey continued to accept online gaming legal bets there, and they, you know, their tax rate didn't go to the floor, whereas in most Indian casinos, there was no revenue at all coming in for the entire pandemic that they were closed. Are they starting to have second thoughts about online gaming that maybe, you know, they could have it in a limited way and just offered by the tribes?
Well, I think tribes are watching developments in Michigan and Florida very closely, and as well as developments in states like Mississippi, where Choctaw has been operating online gaming for a while, to see what the bottom line benefits really will be. But to me, it wasn't that surprising that even where online gaming has started to take off, there's still significant brick and mortar activity. I always kind of equate it to, you know, the idea of you can go and get, you know, a 12 pack of Pepsi, or if you drink beer and drink it at your house all you want. But there's something to be said about going into a social atmosphere, into a bar or a restaurant, and drinking that same Pepsi or alcohol. There's always going to be different types of consumers different types of offerings speak to. And that's true for brick and mortar versus online as well. The one thing I will say about online gaming is when we talk about that merry-go-round of Indian policy and how different tribes are impacted differently, the question is going to be where online gaming is legalized in states with a number of tribes, how Indian country, you know, approaches the Amazon or eBay problem, namely,
right. sure.
if you have a first-to-market operator that has the player data marketing infrastructure already in place, who can take advantage of the online field quickly. How are you going to avoid a situation where that first-to-market operator doesn't dominate the field, creating, thereby creating kingmaking, where you've got one operator that effectively, not by law, but because of commercial competition, dominates the market. Mm-hmm. Some folks would say, well, that's the free market system, and you got to let it work the way it works.
Sure,
but
sure.
We also know that not everybody is going to benefit from widespread legalization when there are only a few operators with the player data information and the marketing infrastructure to take advantage of online gaming.
Yeah.
So I've got some thoughts on those solutions, but that's another podcast.
Yeah, we'll definitely revisit that. So there's been a new administration in Washington, D.C. Just come on. Have you seen any changes in the attitude toward Indian country in general and Indian gaming in specifically?
Well, yes, absolutely. And not all of it driven by the administration itself. There have been, I think, a couple encouraging court cases that I would direct folks to take a close look at. One is City of Council Bluffs versus Department of the Interior, dealing with the Ponca Tribe of Nebraska's lands,
right,
and their eligibility to game on those lands. And the other one is State of Texas versus Alabama Coushatta Tribe of Texas, which is a district court case, mm-hmm, that upheld Alabama Coushatta's right to game on its lands. Both of those dealt with the ability of those tribal nations to game on their lands when states or commercial interests argued that there should be a finding by the courts that a limitation on their gaming should be read into the record. And those cases represent, and with the tribes winning both of those cases, and they're still going to be subject to appeal, but they represent what I think is a trend that hopefully continues, and that is the courts not finding a limitation on tribal operations of gaming on their lands unless Congress explicitly provides those limitations.
Mm-hmm.
And that's an important concept to keep in mind. So the administration has made some given some positive indications about resuming its commitment to putting land into trust, mm-hmm, for tribal nations. It's made some important overtures that decisions are going to be pushed back down to the regional offices rather than having everything be reviewed at headquarters, which slows the process down and subjects it to political decision-making. Those are positive things, but just as positive are the developments that I see in the courts right now.
Sure.
And, you know, at some point I'll talk a little bit about what I've been up to over the last couple,
right,
of years, but separate and apart from gaming, that idea of not reading congressional limitations into the record where it doesn't exist, that was central to the watershed case that my nation, the Muscogee Creek Nation, won in the McGirt decision last year, where our tribal nation's reservation boundaries were affirmed by the U.S. Supreme Court based exactly on this analysis.
Yeah.
The state of Oklahoma and others asked the courts to basically find that through state actions and congressional actions, our reservation didn't exist. Justice Gorsuch, in an incredible decision, said, wait a second, Congress never explicitly disestablished the reservation,
mm-hmm,
so it continues in full force and effect. That's been cited as one of the biggest Indian law cases in the last 100 years.
Sure.
And those other cases that I mentioned, they're not necessarily McGirt cases, but that principle flows through them. And I think we'll see that as a positive development in the gaming community. And as I always point out, Indian gaming isn't a threat to commercial gaming.
Right.
And so the allowance of tribal nations to basically exert their sovereignty on their lands is actually a good thing for, you know, for reasons I've discussed in the past in terms of economies of scale and, you know, penetrating consumer markets. The Indian gaming actually helps commercial gaming. So I think these are good developments all around, both,
sure,
for Indian gaming,
yeah,
and commercial gaming.
Well, you know, you're just leading me into the next question. There's been such an infusion of tribal enterprise, of tribal gaming enterprises into the commercial industry in the past, few years. It started out with the Mohegan tribe in Pennsylvania. Now the Porch tribe actually operates a casino there as well. San Manuel just bought the Palms casino in Vegas. There's two tribes that are fighting it out for a casino in Illinois, and they're the finalists. One of those tribal enterprises will get that casino. And then, of course, just last week, Jim Allen was appointed chairman of the American Gaming Association, the first leader of a tribal gaming enterprise to hold that position. What does this say about tribal gaming as an industry?
Well, I think this is a trajectory that we've recognized for quite some time. In the 30-plus years since IGRA was passed, Indian country has really become the leader in operating gaming in a very complex regulatory environment. Mm-hmm. So, Indian gaming operates in the most regulatory atmosphere of just gaming, but any commercial operation. You've got three layers of regulation. In order to be able to, produce important governmental revenue, you have to understand the balance between sensible regulation and commercial goals. Indian gaming is a leader in that, and as gaming itself is looking to expand to a larger base of consumers, either through online gaming initiatives or further expansion of brick and mortar. Indian gaming is, they have the expertise that even many commercial gaming operators don't have. There's always been a lot of sharing of information and expertise between the industries, but it's no surprise to me that the expertise that has come from running these large-scale operations in these very complicated regulatory environments serves tribal nations very well as they look to gaming in non-Indian environments, not just within the U.S., but internationally as well. And we see tribal nations investing in international commercial gaming projects. And that's because of the expertise they've developed.
Sure.
And incidentally, when you're talking about international gaming environments, think about all the knowledge that comes from operating in a three-tiered regulatory environment.
That's right,
and how useful that is in those operations.
Yeah, no question about it. Well, you've been staying pretty busy since you stepped down as chairman. Give us a little background on what you've been doing the last couple of years.
Oh, sure. Well, as I always say, serving at NIGC was one of the deepest honors of my life. Mm-hmm. But after almost 6 years of service there, I felt that I accomplished a lot along with my teammates.
Sure.
I always missed my service there, but I didn't take a day off.
No.
Immediately after leaving NIGC, I donned two hats, and I've worn those two hats ever since then. One is a tribal official hat, mm-hmm. and I'm honored to serve as my nation, the Muscogee Creek Nation. I'm honored to serve as our ambassador.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a position that was recently created. It was created in 2019 as kind of a throwback to our sovereign roots. Historically, Creek Nation, as most tribal nations, had official diplomats that would engage with the United States as well as other foreign nations, mm-hmm. and tribal nations on matters of government diplomacy. A lot of that fell off the map because of the limitations placed on our ability to self-govern, but we're really at a state of reemergence at Creek Nation, but across Indian country, to go back to that nation-to-nation diplomatic history that mm-hmm. we have. The creation of the ambassadorship was, part of that. And
sure.
So I'm very honored to serve as our ambassador in that role. I work with Congress on a regular basis, as well as federal agencies, as well as other government bodies, other sovereign nations and states and mm-hmm. tribal nations. It's taken up a lot of my time. At the same time, the way they structured it, my nation thought it was very important. I agree that I keep my legal skills sharp, and so I am a practicing attorney. I take on now what I want to take on,
sure.
and I only work with tribal nations whose interests in no way impact Muscogee Creek Nation's interests,
mm-hmm.
but whose interests resonate with my personal commitments to tribal sovereignty and tribal economic development. And so I'm very blessed to be able to be at a place in my career where I can pick and choose projects sure. and folks to work with and things that are consistent with what I believe in. So for the first year and a half or so maybe a year and 9 months or so that I set out in my legal practice, I chaired the Indian Law and Practice Group of a very large law firm. Mm-hmm. Very good relationships with them, but I recently left that firm to do my own thing.
Okay.
Under the banner of Chowdhury Law, the principal there. And the folks that I'm working with are folks that I've kept with me during this entire time. And I work with them on projects that mm-hmm. support, and many of them are gaming projects, but some of them are land use projects or sovereignty projects, things that resonate with what I believe are important to not just the advancement of Indian country, but the U.S. as a whole. I firmly believe what's good for tribal nations is good for the United States, given the fact that our histories are intertwined.
Yeah, no question. Well, I'm sure that your services are in big demand just because of the reputation you established at the NIGC, the integrity and the effectiveness you led the agency with, and I'm sure that you got a lot of customers knocking at your door, and it's nice to be able to pick and choose, though, I'm sure.
It's a busy time, but I'm very honored to be able to have these opportunities.
Sure. Well, John and Deb, thanks for joining us. I really appreciate it, and hopefully we'll see each other in person again real soon.
Sounds great, and always an honor to be on your program, Roger, and thank you for all the important work that you do for the industry and the nation as a whole.
Great. Thank you. Heart of gold,
and I'm getting old.
Hope you enjoyed this week's podcast with thanks again to Konami Gaming. Visit KonamiGaming.com/premiums for more on this year's best slot product, Dimension 49J. To learn more about tribal gaming regulation, visit GGB Magazine or our annual publication, TribalGovernmentGaming.com. To get all the news of the gaming industry delivered to your desktop every Monday morning, visit ggbnews.com and enter the coupon code GGB180 for a free subscription. Don't miss a single episode of the podcast. Sign up on Spotify or Apple Podcasts today. So we'll see you next time on the GGB Podcast.
Heart of gold, and I'm getting old.